News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday on KMJ, whether you listen to us on the AM side, on AM 580, maybe on FM 105.9, or anytime worldwide online at kmjnow.com. You know that each week we visit with veterans, mostly from the World War II generation. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice, preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, and be educated along the way. And boy, are we in for it today. Not many people in this world can tell the stories that Dr. Carl Brown of Corcoran has inside of his head. He's been down here in Corcoran for the last 15, 20 years, worked at the state prison in Corcoran and came in contact with some famous inmates there. But long before that, he was flying during World War II, even before America was involved in World War II. So we're going to go way back in time and talk about that. And you know, Dr. Brown, normally I ask people, the first question is about December 7th, 1941, and what they remember about that. But your adventures in the U.S. military began long before that. You were in college at Michigan State and decided to join the Navy in 1939, is that right?
I had gone down to, because on every Navy Day or any kind of a national holiday, then the Navy had reserve pilots do a demonstration of tactics, dive bombing, and various things. And I wanted to find out if I could get in the Navy. And so the doctors then gave me a physical examination and said, yes, you know, you would qualify to go to Pensacola, where the Navy would train you to fly planes. And that was what I wanted to do, was I wanted to see the world, I guess you use that term. And the Navy was the best way to do it. And plus, you got paid for doing it. So... By golly, all of a sudden, I got a letter, telegram, when I was just sitting down to study differential equations, which is the worst thing you ever run into to try to learn. I got a telegram, would you consider going to Gros Isle for elimination training? That's where they trained you in what they call the Yellow Perils, the Stimson and the naval training planes. And if you soloed all right, according to the instructors, then you would be qualified to be called for when there was an opening at Pensacola.
You're talking about soloing and proving your skills as a pilot. Do you remember what it felt like the first time you got up in the air? And was it love at first flight?
As a dive bomber, the early ones, and they were biplanes. So they put me in the back seat, and I'll be a son of a gun. Next thing I know, I was looking straight at the ground. We were going faster than anybody would want to go towards the ground, and he pulled out, and that means that your stomach ended up at your ankles. And and fortunately, I remembered that they said, if you feel airsick and you're going to vomit, be sure you don't vomit into the wind, because it'll just get all over you in the cockpit. And we had a few people that did that. So that was my introduction to flying, was flying straight down with the skipper of the Gros Isle Naval Reserve Base.
So after that, what convinced you to go back up there, or did you actually like that feeling?
Well, I intended to, quote, see the world, and I wanted to fly big boats. I wanted to fly four-engine from San Francisco area the airport to an L.A. airport to Maui and places like that. But that was the only place you could learn to fly it. When I checked with Boeing, who built the planes, you know, how much did it cost to be checked out as a pilot? And they said $25,000. Well, that was a lot of money before the war. Gold was $35 an ounce, and what you're talking about was a fortune nowadays.
You had never heard of some guy named Claire Chennault or the Flying Tigers. And it sounds like, while most pilots in World War II got in because they wanted to go fight the war, this is before the war, so you thought getting into the military and flying was going to set you up for an aviation career. Is that what? Do I have that right?
Well, I wanted to see the world, and I had been reading World War I paper books. Quick as they'd come on the rack, I'd go read about them, and those guys would be telling all those stories about the Red Baron that was shooting down everybody, but he was using a triplane, and the Swedish war ace was being interviewed. Well, he says, we took off flying into the sun, he says, and couldn't see the enemy planes, he says. All of a sudden, we realized the Fokkers were after us. Well, then the announcer broke in to tell a crowd, he says, the Fokkers are German aircraft. And the Swede says, yeah, he says, they were Messerschmitts.
So that was all the intrigue you needed, and you were excited about this chapter in your life. And when you look back now, and you did go on to serve in the Flying Tigers and were there from the start to the finish, when you think back on now, on your training in Pensacola and all these training flights you took, do you ever think back that maybe you were a bit of a guinea pig because all of this was so new and untested and unproven?
Well, I didn't think of it as being a guinea pig because I was excited.
And it would be exciting to take off and land from a ship, something at this point that not too many people had done around the world. Again, we're still before America's entrance to the war. And you ended up on the USS Saratoga.
The Saratoga and the Lexington were sister ships. They were both built to be battle cruisers. They built the Langley is the name of the first aircraft carrier. It was built on a smaller cruiser chassis. Then they decided to make the Saratoga and the Lexington into battle cruisers, which they were, put a flight deck on them, and they had developed the landing wires and things like that in those days. So all of a sudden, you had two of the largest actual ships in the world anymore. They may not have been bigger than the Titanic, but the Titanic was at the bottom of the ocean. So Tex Hill was a preacher's son who was in the Navy ahead of me and had decided, since they were paying $500, I think, for every German submarine, or they wanted somebody to be flying over the convoys, and when they see a German submarine stalking it, then you dropped a depth bomb, and so when it got anywhere near the submarine, why, it blew up, and once it got a few leaks in it, it had to come up, and when it came up, there were cruisers and destroyers that captured it, so Hitler's submarines took a beating.
And this is all before America was officially at war. But Tex Hill, who people know now as a legendary fighter ace with the Flying Tigers, left the Saratoga for the USS Ranger, which was patrolling the Atlantic, and he could hunt those U-boats there. Then in the spring of 1941, still more than 6 months before the attack on Pearl Harbor, he headed out to China. I know this is all connected to your story, but again, there was a little incentive there. Camco, the aircraft company that was sending 100 P-40s to the American Volunteer Group in China, was promising a hefty bounty for each Japanese plane you could shoot down.
$500 for each Japanese ship you could claim that you shot down with a P-40, which was almost an impossibility when you get right down to it. But Tex Hill then heard that there was a chance to make the money back there, I guess, and that was what they told me. He told me because he had to check me out in his plane, and which I was taking over his spot in the Saratoga. So he checked me out on his plane and took off for back east. And it was on account of that, in September 1940, that my sister, who was a senior in the University of Michigan Medical School and nurses training and ready to graduate, which would mean she would be a head nurse in a hospital wherever she went, was trained for that. Bingo, she got killed in an automobile accident. Well, my father had already passed.
Yeah, so you needed to be there for your mother, and you take leave from the Saratoga having no idea of just how much that was going to mean just yet. But you mentioned your father had died earlier, and I know we're bouncing around a little bit chronologically, but it all ties into your remarkable story here. Your father's death can actually be traced back to his mother and her role in history. So tell me about your grandmother.
Mahala Kice Brown ran one of the underground railway things where they moved runaway slaves through the Oklahoma Territory into the North Dakota Territory into Canada, where they had plenty of forests and lakes and rivers. In other words, they needed help of all kinds up there. So that's what she was involved in, was moving them at night and hiding them in the daytime in the cellar somewhere, because the revenuers were after them, because they could get money from the foreigners who owned all the plantations in Georgia. And they also owned the plantations for tea in India and the plantations for coffee in Africa, meaning that all these plantations were being farmed or worked by slaves, that where they would go in and just take over a whole village in Africa and impress a whole batch and send them over in slave ships.
And you know, we get history lessons every week on this show, but I did not know we'd be going all the way back to the Civil War today. Wow, so your father was the oldest son of Mahala, the one who worked with the Underground Railroad, and I promise we're going to be connecting all the dots here, but your father's premature death can actually be traced back to the family history of helping escaped slaves to freedom.
Because the blacks had bovine tuberculosis and were kept in the cellar during the daytime and this and that, so they all drank out of the same kettle thing. Somebody brought that in, and my father got it in his kidney, and it went to his back. And he was a physician in Nashville, Michigan, driving between Nashville and Vermontville and Hastings and those areas. So he was driving all the time. Initially, he had a horse and wagon and a horse and cutter for the wintertime, and then by the 20s was into Buicks. And so that's what it amounts to, is when he got his TB, got into the back, his vertebrae collapsed.
And after he had an operation at the University of Michigan, they didn't move him enough in recovery. He developed a blood clot that went to his heart and killed him. And you actually worked with doctors later who knew about his case all these years later in Los Angeles?
Some of the doctors happened to be on my father's case and knew all about that. Of course, recognized my name and told me that because this was a death on an orthopedic ward, which was not supposed to happen. So that's how my father died, actually, from use the word, slavery.
Yeah, I see the connection there. And now let's connect it forward here. So you lost your father in 1929. You weren't quite 12 then, but now you're in your 20s. Your sister is killed in a car crash. And since your mother was all alone, you were given leave. If you hadn't left, if you had stayed with that squadron, you likely would have been with them at the Battle of Midway, and you likely would not be talking to us today. We'll get that story when Hometown Heroes continues next with Flying Tiger pilot Carl Brown of Corcoran today on KMJ. He's a Heisman Trophy winner, two-time national champion, and one of the most popular athletes on the planet. And Tim Tebow is coming to Fresno April 5th for the first ever Inspire Gala, a benefit for Fresno Christian Schools and Break the Barriers. Get your tickets now at the Celland Arena box office, Ticketmaster.com, or call 1-800-745-3000. Two great organizations, one big benefit. The Inspire Gala with Tim Tebow, April 5th at the Fresno Convention Center. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common: Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos. Show off your swing and support two great local nonprofits at the CBMC Lana Coffee Golf Classic, Monday, April 8th at Fort Washington Country Club in North Fresno. Did you try Lana Coffee at the Fresno Food Expo? It's coffee for a cause, providing hope for the hill tribes of northern Thailand. Call 348-9000. That's 559-348-9000 to sign up. Or go to Lana Coffee. That's LANNACoffee.org to learn more.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, spending the hour today with 95-year-old Dr. Carl Kice Brown of Corcoran, California, one of the last of the original Flying Tigers who headed overseas before Pearl Harbor to fly against the Japanese in support of Chiang Kai-shek and the Chinese. When we left off, Dr. Brown, we were talking about how you had to leave your squadron of torpedo bombers for your sister's funeral in late 1940. We'll find out why that may have saved your life, but first let's hear about these torpedo bombers that you had been flying from the deck of the Saratoga, those TBDs.
They figured we were expendable because they knew our planes weren't fit to fly against an enemy plane. We only had a couple of 30 guns, a tail gunner, and he couldn't hardly hit anything with that that would amount to anything. And the center man was both a pilot and a naval aviator, but he was an enlisted man. You'd have to spot land and do things, and also landing on the carrier, which was not the easiest thing in the world to be night carrier landing, because you just got a spot that you have to hit in order to catch a wire.
Did you ever go over the side without catching the wire?
No, I never had any accidents, actually, except once. And that wasn't an accident. It's just when I landed in a circle in training, and when I lifted off, the landing gear fell off on one side. So I had to land on one wheel and a wingtip, and that means you had to literally drop in going zero. And when they looked at it then later, they saw that the piece that was left in the plane, right away they saw it had been broken for quite a while, and was rusty, and all the things that would happen to it, and that just nothing was really holding it there. And the same kind of a thing happened when we were flying the F-4Bs, which are the P-12s, which are a Boeing plane, which you had 500 horsepower in your lap and a feather in your tail. That was about all you had. But you could maneuver. More fun to fly that than any plane I've ever flown when you get right down to it. But so the deal was, we were supposed to be flying shooting at a windsock that another plane was towing, and we were supposed to circle, and when you were going to make a run on the windsock, and you had bullets that were marked with different colors, red, yellow, green, and different colors that were painted on the bullets, so that when they hit the sock that was being towed, then it left a color mark, and they could count those and know how many hits you had. So, and meantime, you guys were flying one following the other, and when the man ahead of you intended to take his turn and shoot the windsock, and he had all one color bullets so that they'd know that his bullets had hit it, he was supposed to waggle his wings to let you know that he was going to dive on it. Well, it turns out that he didn't waggle his wings. All of a sudden, I was flying on his wing, which we were supposed to, just a few feet away from him, actually. And by golly, all of a sudden I opened my eyes, because there was the windsock in front of me. He had gone into a dive and hadn't waggled his wings. And fortunately, the officers on the ground had seen that, so that it wasn't my mistake. It was his mistake, but I had more bullets in the sock than he did. So so that's, in a way, how I got into the fighter squadron.
And had you stayed with that squadron, you would have been a sitting duck at the Battle of Midway. There might be a listener or two out there who has heard of Ensign George Gay, the sole survivor. In fact, that's the name of his book, Sole Survivor of Torpedo Squadron 8 at the Battle of Midway. They were flying TBD Devastators, just like the ones you had been flying from the Saratoga. Really no match for enemy fighters. And the experience of those 15 TBDs at Midway backs up your statement that you guys were expendable.
That's the way we took it, because that's the way they treated them, because they were going to send in the TBDs, you know, And that meant that they, if there were fighters in the air, they were going to shoot them down. That's all there was to it. And that's what they did do. They shot down my whole squadron.
Yes, all 15 planes shot down. And of the 30 men, only one, Ensign George Gay, survived. So had you been there, your odds of survival would have been pretty long.
It turns out that the Japanese were all on deck fueling up on their great big carrier, their biggest and best carrier, I guess. And when our dive bombers, who had gotten lost, found the group, and our dive bombers then were able to dive bomb on that big carrier, and I think they sank it and blew up all of the Japanese aircraft that were being refueled.
Yeah, we've had on this program Don Hoff, who was in one of those dive bombers sent from the Enterprise. There were also some from the Yorktown. They got there at the perfect time and really went a long way toward deciding that battle as they knocked out three Japanese carriers with their bombs. So you missed out on that pivotal battle in the Pacific. I know you're not complaining. You're thankful for that. But that was in June of 1942. You'd already been flying P-40s in China for more than 6 months at that point. And I understand your first taste of a P-40 came down in San Diego.
While we were at Coronado, which is two fields, the North and South Field, the Army flew in P-40Bs, and they used up both fields. They landed on their wheels and rolled almost the length of a field before the tail dropped, and then they would end up sort of ground looping at the end. The whole shot being that the 100 planes that they flew there and left at Coronado were hoisted aboard the carrier and landed them at Pearl Harbor, and that's the 100 planes that were destroyed at Pearl Harbor by the Japanese. So that was a quite interesting thing, but it was also instructive because the P-40 was a kind of a plane that you didn't have to land it on its wheels. If you can land the tail first, the wheels will come down. and that was the kind of a thing that made it so that when they asked for volunteers, well, I'd been night carrier trained on the Saratoga with the TBDs.
And I'm curious what it was that convinced you, because, I mean, I know you wanted to see the world, but what was it that convinced you to go join this group, the Flying Tigers, that really would be fighting this war before America was?
You knew that the TBD didn't have a prayer. It just turned out. And you knew that because there's a little red flag that when you screwed the folding wing pin in, so the tip of the wing was a regular wing, and you had to spin that little wheel in the cockpit in order to screw that down until you saw that red flag come up. The swabby, or whatever you want to call them, were supposed to check for looseness by flapping the wing tip to be sure that there wasn't any give in it, so that it was being held out by the piston instead of by the pin. And so Bordy Rowlater was the name of one of my pilots, or, well, I think he was a Lexington pilot, actually. But he took off, and just as he turned around the Coronado Hotel, that wing folded on him, and he spun in the river there. And that was a wicked thing. When if you didn't be sure that you saw that red flag go down, hopefully expect to have your wingtip hoisted up and down to be sure there wasn't any looseness that would suggest that it wasn't locked.
And when you saw stuff like that happen, did you ever worry that that fate could be waiting for you, that something like that would happen to you?
I guess the word worry was misplaced, really, because there wasn't anything to worry about. You worry about things that you could maybe do something about. But it wasn't until all of a sudden, when Chenault had made his deal to take 100 pilots, bingo.
So you're one of these 100 pilots going over with Chenault. America's not at war yet, but here you are ready to go fly in China against the Japanese. What was it like once you got there to China? What did you figure out?
We got to Burma first. We took the train up to Tunggu. And from Tunggu, then, that's where you met your instructors and where Chenault had his headquarters at the time. And ultimately, he moved all that up to the university at Kunming, which was somewhere near the field. And The field at Kunming was, we were, the first squadron was based near that, and we called ourselves the first squadron, and we called ourselves the first pursuit. And that was Adam chasing Eve, and that's why we were called Adam and Eve, was because Adam chasing Eve was the first pursuit. And that's how it got the name, and then they had different names for some of the others, but I was in the first pursuit, and we shot down the first planes that were shot down and hit the ground and within the warning net where they could get pieces of the plane and knew what it was, and all the pilots and all that had been killed in the crash. I guess they ran out of gas because they had enough bullets to lose their fuel before they could get to Japanese-owned territory. And they had to crash land because there was no landing field. And so wherever they landed, there was things sticking up that smashed the planes. And right away, the Chinese farmers went after them with pitchforks and things and put an end to the Japanese pilots.
You know, there's so much that's been made in all the years about whether or not people know what they're fighting for. Over there in China, going against the Japanese, did you know what you were fighting for? What was it that motivated you or drove you?
Number one, I wasn't fighting for money, to coin a phrase, because almost everybody that was fighting for money was trying to shoot the planes in territory where you had no business being. If you went down, then you were sacrificed in a literal sense. And we lost a bunch of pilots. That some scout had said there's 200 Japanese planes lined up here where they refuel, and they also refuel German submarines. Since the plane wasn't fit to fly at night and they could make some guards for it, they fitted some baffles. And I had been checked out as a night carrier pilot, so I was able to volunteer to fly at night because I knew damn well that the Japanese weren't going to catch me at night. And what they would do then was put a big yellow streak in down the airstrip and parked cars with their headlights lighting that yellow streak so that you could see it and see where the end was. As long as you didn't drift to either side, you'd hit one of those cars, which somebody did, and killed one of our pilots who was sleeping in the back of it. So I was doing night flying mostly, which was based on looking for signs of collections, where they had taken over an area and had their planes all lined up.
You mentioned flying at night and the baffles, and you actually had to fly a P-40 at night with nothing to mask the fiery flames of the exhaust. Sounds like you were flying blind there for a while.
Later built P-40s, they didn't put baffles on the exhaust, so that the first time you took off at night, bingo, you were like just flying into a fire pit because you couldn't see a thing to know that the prop was turning except for the noise. And it was a wicked experiment to try to fly one of those at night before they put the baffles on it. And fortunately, they did.
Yeah, it would have been hard to do what you did if they hadn't. But there were some other catches, like the time you were staying with some British-trained Indian troops who didn't fill up your plane quite right.
The expansion tank was behind your right ear. They filled it up only so full, but that expansion tank was supposed to handle that. But instead of that, they used it like they did the Hurricanes and others, British ships. They filled it clear up, put the cap on. Well, they had a different system, so that to end up with the cockpit full of oil, and that's what happened when I didn't know that that was the way it was. You always check to see that the cap was on and that kind of stuff. But
so you take off, and what happens?
Well, all of a sudden I was covered with oil, and I had to stick my head out to the side in order to swing around and literally land leaning out of the cockpit as far as I could, with the seat up as high as it would go.
Was that a little nerve-wracking for you?
Well, it was. You were happy when it rolled to a stop. That's right. But And you don't use the word nerve-wracking because you're too busy to think about that kind of stuff.
Understandably so. Well, I know you have so many stories to share. We need to catch another break here. Then we'll see how much more we can fit in today with 95-year-old Dr. Carl Brown of Corcoran, California. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
Hey, Bulldog fans. Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening to a few stories from the incredible life of Dr. Carl K. Brown of Corcoran, one of our last links to the original Flying Tigers, the American volunteer group flying outdated and under-equipped planes that did look a little meaner with the shark teeth on their nose, but working within an infrastructure planned and built by Claire Chennault, who had been in China working with Chiang Kai-shek for several years. One of the Flying Tiger's finest moments came at the Salween Gorge. The Japanese army had advanced up the Burma Road and was about to cross the Salween River. The Chinese blew up the only bridge there, but the Japanese were working hard to get their supplies across, and it would have really hurt Chinese chances. Our guest today, Carl Brown, is one of the Flying Tigers who flew that fateful mission. What do you remember about that day?
The Japanese were up there logging and building rafts so they could haul across the Salween Gorge, could take heavy equipment across there, bombs and tanks and things, so they could put a stop to Kunming, because they didn't have army enough to hold them up there. If they, in other words, they would put a stop to supplying Chiang Kai-shek, or Chiang Kai-shek, we called him Chiang Kai-shek, all his supplies, because that kept a bunch of the Japanese busy when we had bases that we could touch down on and get the Chennault's people had 100-gallon barrels of sealed barrels buried around these fields, and so that you could land and get in full tanks to take off and go back to Kunming. We had tanks or hooks on each wing, which you could hook extra fuel tanks on for long range scouting or a long range mission. But you could also they gerrymandered it, I guess your term, so that it would hold a bomb. And the bombs then had a little fan in the nose of it so that it armed itself on its way down. It would spin that little spinner, and that would, so just walking by and kicking it or bumping it wouldn't blow it up. It wasn't armed at all. But that's what happened. I was flying on Bob Little's wing all of a sudden while I was flying close to on his wing, so that if we got anywhere near a target, it'd be double fire on him, because we had 250s in the nose, and I don't think we had any wing winds. Just had the 250s in the nose, which then didn't fire any faster than the prop triggered it in order to not hit the prop. But the later models, the P-40 E's, had three 50s, I think, in each wing, and that fused ahead of you a good distance away, so there was a lot of lead. You could spill a lot of lead there, but for some reason or other, ground fire apparently fired the bomb under Bob Little's wing, and all of a sudden the plane I was flying on, I was flying on his left side, and Bingo, his wing blew off, and he spun off right there. And that was, I didn't see him land or crash, but you knew he did. But I just mean that from there, you got out of there. And there were some planes behind us, taxi, and a bunch of them were behind us. By that time, gunfire had put them out of commission of hurting any of them, so I don't think they lost any more planes there than Bob Little at the time.
What did that do to you to see that happen right next to you?
Well, I got out of there. I mean, put as much time, put as fast as you could, headed back for Kunming because there wasn't any reason to fly into fire when you had no armor.
It didn't shake you up at all to see that?
Well, yeah, I wrote a story about it. I've got a story somewhere.
Give us the gist of it.
What it is, and it's what it amounted to, was the mechanics realizing who it was. When we circled the field and came back, and that plane was not there, and so
when the mechanics realized that he wasn't coming back, they were pretty moved by that.
Many of the mechanics were Chinese, and some Indians, Indians, who had been trained in safe areas, the engine and the plane, because the plane was a P-36, and there's a lot of those had been sent all over the world with the radial engines. Thinking back, it's hard to think of anything except having close calls was an occasional event. And one of them was that in a practice with the Lexington, a bunch of other planes out in the Maui area. I think we were based on Maui, but shore-based temporarily. And the destroyer went through and laid a smoke screen, and the torpedo planes then, the TBDs, were supposed to stay below 50 feet type thing, so that if you weren't as close as 30 feet from the water, usually, you didn't dare to get any closer than that, because the torque from any kind of a big gun would be enough to spin you into the water, and so you had to stay above 30 feet, And if you went too high, like 50 feet, then the torpedo would have a chance to lose its forward angle and end up being sheared when it hit the water, and that would destroy its usefulness. So we had to fly through this cloud, and right on my, I could almost reach out and touch it, was the mast of a destroyer, our destroyer, which the smoke screen had drifted over so that it wasn't visible unless you were within 50 feet of it, and that means you were in the smoke screen. And then when you popped out on the other side, there was, quote, the target, and so you promptly had to drop your torpedo.
So this is just a training exercise, but you almost collided with your destroyer's mast.
Oh, that's right. That's correct. I was, it seems like I reached out and like can hear the TV and touch it. I mean, it was one thing, and a scary thing, to coin a phrase. Yeah. And occasionally you had other scary things happen, but you didn't know about it until afterwards, because you wouldn't know about it if it had happened. So there you go.
And you look back now, you're 95 years old. You've got children and grandchildren. You ever think back about all those close calls?
Yeah, I have occasionally pieced it together.
Because they wouldn't be here.
Yeah, that's what it amounts to.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you find it somewhat remarkable that you were able to survive every situation where you put yourself in harm's way?
Well, yes, it's remarkable, but not remarkable. It was just amazing to consider, if you want to use a term, having that much break your way.
How do you account for that? What do you think was taking place there?
Well, you can't really account for it. You don't know whether or not there was anything else you were intended to do by the powers that be. In other words, that all comes in the, I use the word, the spiritual field. And
you were talking about Shankar Jack or Chiang Kai-shek. Did you meet Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chang?
The term meeting would be yes in that sense, but not in the shake hands sense. But the madam was English, was American Chinese.
How was it that you met him? Was it a reception to honor you flying Tiger pilots, or how did you encounter Chiang Kai-shek?
He didn't stay around our area. He stayed up in Beijing or somewhere, and he would come down once in a while, and they would have a dinner meeting. Those would be at graduation meetings. Every time we would graduate a group of pilots and solo them in the planes that they had over there, then they would come to the field in Tucson area, I guess, trying to think of Thunderbird Field, I think they called it.
Did you feel honored to meet Chiang Kai-shek and Madam Chiang? Was it a big deal to you at the time?
Not personally honored in that sense, except the madam was an American Chinese and had taken to us and called us her boys and all that kind of stuff. So, and then, of course, had connections back in the United States.
What about Claire Chennault? What kind of guy was he, and what were your impressions of him?
Well, he was a good guy, and he was in charge. And he had established, apparently, the warning net, which the Chinese had cleaned off fields and stored barrels of fuel, caves that they dug and stuff like that all over China.
Yeah, it was quite the organization. We're running short on time here, but I want to hear about what you did when you came home from China.
I was in the Navy already when the draft was set up, so I never had a draft number. I came back to the States on ships that were bringing in mostly missionaries and families and like that, military cargo type things. And landed at Long Beach, and when got off then, I was looking to go to college already, and I wanted to be a physician, and the University of Southern California was the only school that was near enough to get in. They didn't have one yet at UCLA. So it turns out that Dr. Delameter, I think his name was the assistant dean, and I had put in my application at the University of Southern California Medical School. B is on top of the pile of mimeograph forms.
Because your name's Brown, so in alphabetical order, you're right on top.
Yeah, they were on top, and the sun came through and had eaten up, or the ultraviolet had burned off the everything except my handwritten stuff. And so the dean's wife had listened to an interview that I was doing on the radio at ABC radio in downtown LA, and she heard it, and when she heard I was trying to get into school at University of Southern California Medical School, she went and looked, and then she found my name back in a couple of sheets behind, because the my name had been right on top and wasn't being considered at all to get into school, because they hadn't gotten to it yet. And so then when I got there with Dr. Delameter, he interviewed me about being in China, and he had been over there with MacArthur part of the time and told about bodies floating down the stream and all this and that. And so it was sort of on account of being in the Flying Tigers that I got into medical school, because there were people from Stanford and other places that had, especially the girls in our class, that had much better grades than I had. So I graduated in 1952. I later discovered I wanted to do neurology. Neurology then was done at the VA hospital in Long Beach.
So you got through medical school. Your father was a doctor. Now you have two sons who are physicians. And your daughter, Jessica, who told me about you, is a nurse at the VA hospital in Fresno. I guess you have a pretty medical family, don't you?
Well, yeah, there's quite a lot of physicians. And, of course, that exposes you to a little bit of everything.
It was medicine that would bring you here to the San Joaquin Valley, and that's why you're in Corcoran here. For many years, you served out at Corcoran State Prison. I guess it's an interesting connection, and you have a lot of connections in your life. But one of the decorated pilots in the Flying Tigers and in that theater was a guy from Hanford, right up the road in Kings County here, named Charles Older. He went on to become a judge, and he was involved in sentencing the Manson family. And at Corcoran State Prison, one of your patients at one point was Charles Manson?
Yes, he was actually the term patient, and so he was a prisoner, and somebody had to investigate the only place he could conceal things like razor blades and stuff. And these people were known to have broken a piece off from a razor blade that they were watched while they were using it. They would hold it between their teeth and reach over and cut the artery on the man beside him when he was of the wrong gang in L.A., for instance. The Crips and the Bloods and the different people in L.A. were still fighting up here in the prison yard. And so,
what about Manson? You had to investigate whether he was hiding anything? And how'd that go?
Yes, of course, Manson was, he was a walk-alone type thing. In other words, he was never let out on the yard.
And I don't want to dwell on this too long, but with regard to Manson, you know, you grew up, you're fighting in a war where there are characters like Hitler and Mussolini and Tojo and people that someone would say that's evil personified. Having to give Manson a prostate exam or check his body cavities to look for contraband, was it disturbing to come in contact with someone who had done what he did?
Well, not disturbing in the sense that I would be disturbed, because I was practicing neurology and psychiatry, and that means that you're talking about the brain, and mostly most people in their left brain, and the left-handers are in their right brain. So I knew, being a left-hander, I knew who their right brains were. But the chief of the clinics would give them their pills through the window and like that, and you always had an officer with you, and you never sat down in their presence because they would have things stuck in their shoe and try to kick you and do things like that.
Sounds like for you, with regard to Manson, it was really no different for you than with any other inmate.
No, you had to treat him as a patient. I mean, and that's what it amounts to, yeah.
Just another of the famous and or infamous individuals that you've encountered in 95 years on this earth. Dr. Brown, thank you for serving our country. I'm glad they finally got you guys those Distinguished Flying Crosses in 1996. Thank you for telling us some of your story. And you at home, thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today on KMJ.